I'm supposed to talk about the importance of issues, something that is important to me, something that I try to do three times a week in my own life. I've been doing that now for almost 4 years. And issues are the basis of a campaign, in my opinion. Janine told us yesterday in the executive committee meeting that candidates are how you build a party. Candidates are a party building, too, running candidates for office. And you should run candidates, she said, that can help you achieve and maintain ballot access. So these candidates have to know something about the issues, don't they, in whatever campaign they happen to be running in. So we'll talk about some issues today, some specific issues, and then we'll talk a little bit about what it means to be a candidate, hopefully when Randy and these other gentlemen are through passing that out. One issue that I can talk to you about right now is something that I have pondered on throughout my life, and really here lately a lot more, and that is, what is the meaning of life? Or said differently, what determines life's meaning? I pondered on that, and I thought, well, where do we derive the meaning of life? I mean, I thought, maybe it's God. I mean, He created us. He holds every breath in His hands, doesn't He? Perhaps He is the meaning of life, but no. We don't have to wait anymore. We don't have to wonder anymore. See, the First Lady of the United States told us the other day, a couple of days ago, she said, life's meaning is found in splurging. That's right, that's what she said, in splurging. So the meaning to life, apparently, according to the First Lady, is spending money excessively that you don't have on things that you don't want or need. That is where you find the meaning of life. Now, if you carry that one step further and you look at, this is where the issue comes in, folks, if you look at the fact that many Americans live, we'll say hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck would be a better way to put it. I see them every day in my law office, many times a day usually, things are not good out there in middle America. What is middle America? Well, it's $50,000 a year. That is middle America. That's the median income in America. Now, that means that half the people make less, half make more than that. But to reach the 75th percentile, you have to make $85,000. In other words, above $85,000, you're in the top 25% of income earners in America. Well, you can see that that is not a hugely excessive amount of income in this day and age. And at the same time, we hear the administration rail on and on about the 1% and the 99%. They just don't tell us that they're all in the 1%. But be that as it may, the Federal Reserve pumps money into Wall Street to pump up the stock market while the rest of America gets killed, those who aren't in hedge funds and so forth. No offense, Mr. Shuler. The 99% suffer and the 1% doesn't. To me, that's a pretty good issue when you look at the lavish lifestyles that some people are living as they hold public office. The vacations that they take, that may be just a bit, excessive. I mean, there seems to be no understanding that perhaps it's just not cool to be that cool. So that is a good issue. What is another? Well, a few days ago, I think it was Wednesday. You lose track of time at these meetings. This is Saturday, isn't it? I think. Wednesday, CNN sent out one of their alerts, and they said that the Veterans Administration, this goes to personalizing issues. You can personalize the last issue on middle America suffering retirement being destroyed by zero interest rates, people having to transfer retirement funds into riskier investments to try to get some return, that sort of thing. But you can personalize that. Everybody knows a retired person. Some of us may be even in that category or close to it. But the Veterans Administration, and who doesn't know a veteran of some type, possibly World War II type or Korea? My brother's a Korean War veteran. He was at my house just a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago. He's about 83 now, and he seems fine. I mean, he's not suicidally depressed or anything like that. He's got some health problems that he is treated at the VA hospital for. But in Phoenix the other day, the Phoenix Veterans Administration killed 40 veterans by neglecting their medical care on purpose. They put 1,400 to 1,500 veterans on a, quote, secret list of denial of care because they said, we don't have the ability to care for you. So they just secretly put these men's names on a list to where they were denied care. And while that was going on, 40 of them died. And apparently, this is happening all across the country. So if you think about your brother, your father, whoever it might be, grandfather, could be one of those people. I mean, maybe one of those men was at Omaha Beach or Porkchop Hill or something like that, but that's lost on these folks. They don't care, and it's meaningless to them. To me, that's a pretty good issue because it comes home to most of us. It certainly does to me. Now, there are other issues that are good no matter where you're running. Whether you're running for president or whether you're running for alderman in your local community or county commission or city commission, whatever you call it, there's always an issue that you can personalize. In my little community of Germantown, about 10 miles east of here, where hopefully several of you will appear tonight for a magnificent barbecue party, the mayor, who's been mayor for 20 years, she just said she was not going to run for re-election, but she's all into Agenda 21 now, and she's into red light cameras and stuff like that, which infuriated me. I mean, I thought about going around door to door saying, do you really want these cameras? Because about every 6 months you get a letter that says, send us $50. I said, you know, why don't you steal from us honestly and just tell us, you know, you're being taxed $50 and there's nothing you can do about it. But anyway, those are issues, if nothing else. Common Core is an issue on every level, from the highest to the lowest. As someone said a minute ago, it's worldwide now. It's very common, this core. Obamacare, personalize the issues. I met a lady the other day. Joan knows who I'm talking about, this woman. But this is how you personalize an issue. This is an actual case in Obamacare. This woman's 70 years old. Her husband of 42 years died about a year and a half ago. Essentially, she's destitute because they did not qualify for Social Security for one reason or another. The way they lived their lives, they essentially were missionaries in a non-affiliated type of thing. And she has nothing. I mean, her income is less than $1,000 a month. And she has no health coverage because, as it turns out, Obamacare is not as friendly to you if you have no Medicare coverage. But she did apply. I talked to her about it, and she applied, and she had help from one of these hospitals that owns a bunch of emergency clinics. She had injured herself, and went to one of these emergency clinics, but at least I was able to make a little money from her injury. But that's another story. But anyway, this hospital wrote her, the bill was paid for the injury, and they said, look, we understand that you don't have any insurance, and we can help you with that. We can help you get coverage through Obamacare. So I said, well, yep, by all means, let's do that. So this gentleman from one of the Obamacare navigators, when she contacted him, called her. This is a Marco Rubio moment here. I called her and said, there are many different plans that you could qualify for. And she said, well, let's start with the cheapest one. Just tell me how the cheapest possible plan that you have, how much would it cost me? And they said, well, it'd be $370 a month, and it's a $4,000 deductible, and it only pays half of any hospitalization. Well, to this woman, that is nothing. That's basically uninsured. I mean, number one, it's almost 50% of her income. This is after the government subsidy. So the point is, it's a personal thing with her. She's still uninsured, as are tens of millions of other people. Everybody was supposed to be insured, but they're not. There are still plenty of people out there that can't get it, that can't afford it, even with the subsidy. So that is a very personal issue to many people. Then you have the broader issues like Benghazi Gate, which takes us back to veterans once again and neglect of the government, IRS attacks on conservative groups. We can blame the Republicans for both of these, for refusing to be aggressive in their prosecution, their investigation. A special prosecutor should be appointed for both of them, but the Republicans don't have the courage to insist like the Democrats did back in the 70s when they were prosecuting Nixon. When Hillary Clinton prosecuted Nixon, I can still hear her saying, what did the president know, and when did he know it? The same thing applies today, I would think. Amen. That trail goes to the White House. But anyway, those are issues if you want to talk national politics, and some of you are in a position to do that. But you can put it all down to your local area, and you have to find issues to talk about. You have to build your campaign around them. I mean, you can't just say, when people say, why are you running? You can't just say, because I don't like the way things are. I mean, that's an answer, but it's not an adequate answer. You've got to give people a reason to choose you instead of one of the others. And if we go into this thinking, knowing in our hearts we're going to lose, we can still do the best that we can do. I mean, if you were campaigning against Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush for the office of President of the United States, you might be a bit optimistic if you said, I'm going to win, I'm going to be elected president. That doesn't mean you're excused from doing the very best that you can. It doesn't mean that you're excused from giving it everything that you can give. Janine said earlier that she is essentially a full-time person at this kind of work. Whether you have a full-time job like I do or whether you don't, you can still do the best that you could do. I mean, I thought back in 2008 I was kind of naive. I was driving down the street in Kansas City one day, and Chuck Baldwin called me, and he said, hey, would you consider being my vice presidential running mate? I thought, well, that's something to think about. So I did think about it, and I finally said yes, but it was a scary moment when I came to grips with how really ill-prepared I was to be a candidate. But I'll tell you what, somebody talked about on-the-job training. I wasn't trained as vice president, but I was trained as a candidate, I can tell you that, because you know, I faced some cameras that I was not used to dealing with, and I had to learn fast, and so I did. And here's the coming to the finality of this. The way I did it was, I observed people, and I noticed that the people who could speak, like Laurence Olivier or Richard Burton, and get people up out of their seats to where they would stand and give him a standing O, those people, I noticed, never said anything. After they finished speaking, everybody was excited, but I would think, what did he actually say? And it was not anything. And I said, you know, I'm not Richard Burton, but I can at least say something. And one of our dear friends, who's not here today, but If I told you his name, you would all know him. I read a comment that he made about me on a blog or something a couple of years ago, and his evaluation of me was smart but boring. So maybe that is my gift. If so, I accept it. But I'll tell you a story that comes from history about 3,000 years ago, where this will make some degree of sense to you, hopefully. But this goes back to the time in Israel when there was no king over Israel. There was God who ruled Israel through the prophets. At this time, the prophet was Samuel. You can find this in the book of 1 Samuel, starting in chapter 8. But Samuel was getting older. And the people said, "You're getting older. You can't cut it anymore. And your sons are not good people. So we want a king to rule over us, somebody that will rule us. We can be like everyone else." And Samuel said, "Well, if you do that, he is going to take your sons and put them in the military service. He's going to take your daughters and make prostitutes and consorts out of them. He's going to steal your property, your land, your cattle." So, you know, what goes around comes around. I mean, things don't change. 3,000 years later, the king is still the same.
Amen.
But the people said, "We don't care. We want the king anyway." So Samuel went back to God, and God said, "Give them what they want, and don't feel bad about it," he said, "because they have not rejected you. They have rejected me." And so Samuel found this man named Saul, and Saul was 30 years old when he was anointed king. He was the perfect king, just like today you see the perfect candidates on television. This man was handsome. He was a head taller than any other man in Israel. He looked like a king. I mean, look at them on TV today. Which ones of them don't look like kings? I mean, there aren't any really ugly people out there, at least not on the male side. Saul was anointed king when he was 30 years old, and Samuel told him, "You're going to encounter God, and he is going to change you. You'll be a different person." And he actually became a good king at first, and he ruled over Israel for 42 years. During that 42 years, he was almost constantly at war with the Philistines, just like Samuel had told them. He took their sons and pressed them into service. And this war, the Philistines were superior in numbers and equipment to the Israelites most of the time. And Saul had a bad habit of attacking them where they were strongest and he was weakest. And one day he did that, and God told Samuel to go to him and say, you're out. You're not going to be king anymore, and there's no changing my mind." So Samuel did that. He said, "Saul, you've done a bad thing. You're a goner. And there is one coming who is better than you. He's a man after God's own heart," he told him. And so God told Samuel to go and find this man named Jesse and interview his sons. Jesse had 8 sons, and he said one of them is going to be anointed king. And Jesse brought 7 sons to the interview. One of them, he was so bad he didn't even make the interview. And so he brought them out one by one, and the oldest was a man kind of like Saul, very good looking. In today's terms, he probably went to Harvard Law School. He had a million-dollar smile, and you look at him and you think, king. That's a king right there. And Samuel said to God, "Surely this is the one." And God said, "No, it's not the one." So they all went by one after one, and he said, "No, none of them." And he said, "Is there no one else?" And Jesse, the father, said, "Surely one of these men is king. I mean, look at them." And Samuel said, "Well, God doesn't care about their appearance. He looks at their heart." And so he said, I have one other son. He's out tending sheep, which in that day was one of the lowest occupations. This is where we come in, see. He said, I mean, the sheep herder was a low occupation back then. They sent kind of like people like us, I guess, out to be sheep herders. Samuel said, go and bring him here. So he brought him in, and David at that time was just a little boy. And he said, that's the one, as soon as he saw him. David was anointed. And a while later, Saul's army was locked in battle with the Philistines again. And, I mean, I know you all know this story, but perhaps you haven't heard it in a while. They were laid out across this valley, the Philistines on one side of the valley and the Israelites on the other. Philistines having a stronger army. More importantly, they had a champion. It'd be nice if it were still like that today, wouldn't it? Kings could fight their own battles. We could just let Obama and Putin square off somewhere and leave the rest of us alone. Every day this champion named Goliath would come out into the valley from the Philistines, and he would yell at the Israelites, and he would curse them and tell them to send somebody out to face him. But nobody ever did. All the Israelites cowered in fear, including Saul, the king. Saul had this beautiful polished bronze armor on that he did not care to face this man who was apparently 9 feet tall in battle. So Jesse, David's father, sent him up to the camp with some food and drink for the people who were up there fighting. And he went to see his brothers while he was there, and Goliath happened to come out, and he said, what's this? I mean, as the scripture says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that screams at the army of the living God? And they all said, you know, you just need to shut up and go back and herd your sheep. So he went to the man that, like Saul's assistant, and he said, what's going on? And he told him, and he said, so, you know, I'll go face him. And so he took him to Saul, and Saul said, you know, you're just a kid. And he said, I don't fear him. He said, I serve the living God. I'm not afraid of him. So Saul said, I'll tell you what, I'll let you wear my armor. You go and fight him. You can wear my armor of polished bronze. So he took this big old helmet and this armor, and he put it on David. And David tried to walk around in it, and he couldn't. It was uncomfortable. It didn't fit. And he said, I don't want your armor, which is a clue for you. Don't wear anybody's borrowed armor, only the armor that God gave you. Mine happens to be smart but boring. So that is what I wear. I've had many opportunities to change that. I've had people offer to send me to special schools where I would learn to be not quite so boring and maybe stupider at the same time. But I resisted those efforts. But anyway, I did go to a school, though, by the way. When I was a candidate, Chuck and I went to the school for 2 days. This lady had been press secretary under Ronald Reagan, and she had a candidate school that was excellent. It taught you how to deal with the media, how to answer their questions without saying anything, and how to evade questions and not answer the question, essentially, is what she told me, that I was charmingly honest and I had my work cut out for me. But anyway, David goes out to face Goliath, having nothing but his shepherd's clothing and a sling with 5 river stones in it, 5 smooth stones. And Goliath comes out, and he says, the army of Israel insults me by sending a child to face me. He said, I will cut off your head and feed your carcass to the birds. And David said, I do not fear you, because I serve the living God, and it is I who will cut off your head, and it is I who will feed you to the birds. And David, as Goliath started to draw his sword, David took one of those stones and sunk it into Goliath's forehead. And he fell dead. And he went over and took his sword and cut Goliath's head off and carried it into Saul's tent. And Saul said to his assistant, "Who is this man's father?" And the man said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, go and find out." And then Saul started to, of course, see his competition. But the point is, David, this young candidate, this shepherd, ruled over Israel for many years. He had many sons, some good, most bad. He controlled the enemies of Israel for many years, but he could not control the sin in his own heart. And it cost him everything. That is human nature, folks. That's the way it is. That is life as a candidate, both victorious and losing. So you go out, do the best that you can do, and remember the issues and don't fear them. Just say in your own heart, "I serve the living God. I'm not afraid of you. What can you do to me that's worse than what you're already doing?" Anyway, folks, that's the way I see it. Thank you for listening to me.